Want to say happy Easter to everybody, and being that this is Easter Sunday, I guess that'd be a good thing to talk about today. Hopefully, this lesson that I've chosen and prepared, I want to do part of it today, and if possible, do the other part next Sunday. And rest me, let me do it, finish it up next Sunday. I don't know with the number of people I see here today, we might get through the whole thing today. But hopefully it'll work out, and we'll do what we can do. I want to start off with, because it's Easter Sunday, when you say Easter, I like to ask a question. I don't want to put nobody on the spot or anything or make you feel like, you know, you don't want to answer because it may be a wrong answer. There's no wrong answer. It's just a question I throw out this morning. What does Easter mean? And I guess you could say, what does it mean to you? I'll start off with, when I was younger, Easter meant eating a whole lot of eggs. And going to Easter egg hunt somewhere and finding eggs. And as I got a little bit older, then Easter meant have something new to wear to church on Sunday. And I could pretty much look forward to having either a new suit or a new pair of shoes or a new shirt or something until I got old enough where I had to start buying my own clothes. And then that went out the window. So I ain't had to worry about that. It didn't mean had the same meaning for me. But I'd like to ask you all, anybody want the answer, what does Easter mean to you, or what do you think Easter means, or what comes to mind when you think of Easter? Anybody want to chip in, jump in, and give a remark, comment? Yeah.
I would sometimes get some, but the guys didn't always get new clothes. But every now and then we'd have something new to wear, too.
Yeah.
And then having an Easter egg hunt.
Right.
Usually mom and dad would, or mom or dad would hide eggs the first time and we'd go look for them. And then after that, different people would take turns hiding eggs. So, it was fun.
Yeah. That was one thing you definitely could look forward to, was going to eat some Easter eggs. You know, if you didn't eat no eggs no other time of the year, you're definitely going to have some eggs during Easter.
Yeah,
ball eggs, and didn't even worry about salt too much. You know, just as long as you got an egg, you found the egg, you was good to go. Go ahead. Okay.
And we went to church on Sunday, and we went to eat fried chicken and collard greens and butter beans and macaroni and cheese, candy ham, you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I had good meal.
That was on Easter. But on Easter Monday, we had the Easter egg hunt.
Right. Okay. Yeah, a lot of churches usually will sponsor Easter egg hunts, and you get a lot of kids will come from different places. They will come to church that time of the year if you didn't see them no other time of the year. And I know at the church that I attended when I was younger, we would see a lot of people that would come to church on Easter Sunday. If we hadn't seen them the rest of the year before, you might see them on Easter Sunday, maybe a couple of Sundays after that, and then you wouldn't see them again for a while, you know. But you knew you were going to see some people you hadn't seen in a while on an Easter Sunday. Yeah, yeah. Mostly is Easter Sunday and Mother's Day Sunday. You're going to see some people you hadn't seen in a while. Yeah, yeah, sometimes Christmas. Well, some people would say that, you know, most people would think of the fact that, you think of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection on Easter because somebody's going to talk about it during Easter. That's when Christ rose from the grave on the third day. And our Christian faith is based on the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. The church is founded on that foundation of Christ dying, being buried, and rising again on the third day. And that's what our faith is based on. That's what we know. That's the most important thing. If Christ hadn't risen on the third day, then our whole purpose wouldn't have any meaning whatsoever. Now, with that truth being known, that was a hard thing for Christ's disciples to take in during that time because they didn't understand the fact that he was going to die and leave them, and he told them that he was going to rise again. But it was a hard thing because it's never been done. Nobody that had died had ever rose again. I mean, he raised Lazarus, but he raised Lazarus. Lazarus didn't raise himself. So that was a hard thing for them to take in and to grasp. And during that time of the year for them, they were celebrating a feast called the Passover, which was commemorating the saving of the Israelites out of Egypt, coming out of bondage, and how God brought them out of bondage. So that was the thing that they remembered at that time of the year to celebrate. And when Christ told them about his death, which was going to be a sacrifice for them, he tried to explain it to them that it was going to be it would be a great loss for them, but it would also mean a new life for them, because then they would have something that they could depend on for what goes on after death. But again, that was a hard thing for them to grasp. Them being together for 3 years up to that point, they had come to accept Christ as the Messiah. They had seen him perform miracles, and they believed in him, and they trusted him, and they even pledged to give their life for him. You know, they was willing to go to that extreme. Of course, as we know, when the time came that Peter was there with him in the courtyard, he refused, you know, denied him three times. And Christ told him beforehand that he would deny him three times before the rooster crowed. And he did it because Christ knew that, but he didn't. But at the time, he thought that he would be faithful to him, which we at times sometimes say things like, I wouldn't have did that, or I would do so and so. If this happened to me, I would do this, that, and the other. But we never know what we would do until that particular time comes and we are faced with that situation, and then what we think we would do, we say, but what actually happens doesn't really come to life until we are faced with that situation.
But they were willing to pick up swords and fight the Romans if Jesus told them to.
Yeah.
Fighting for the liberation of the Jewish
Yeah, I think because they had so much faith in him being the Messiah that he was going to fix everything.
Oh, yeah. Because they pictured, you know, since he was going to come and sit on David's throne, you know, according to their prophecies, then they pictured he was going to be a mighty military leader.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And the fact that he tried to tell them plenty of times beforehand that it wasn't exactly the way that they had pictured it, and that he would give his life, he would die. You can look at Mark chapter 8 and verses 31 to 33, the first time he tried to tell them what was going to happen. I'll read that right quick. Mark chapter 8, verses 31-33. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He spoke these words openly. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned around and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." See, he tried to let them know that it wasn't going to be the way they were thinking. As you said, he was going to sit on David's throne and conquer the Romans, and because that's what they were accustomed to, maybe a mighty battle, and the victor would conquer the people, and you know they would have slaves, and then you know they would have a big parade, and you know this is what they were accustomed to, but this was not the kind of thing that Christ was going to do, and he was trying to tell them that in order for the scriptures to be fulfilled, that he would have to give his life, and the things would change, but it wouldn't be the way that they were expecting it to be. But Peter, being outspoken as he was, was saying, no, that's not going to happen. We're not going this is not what we want to see happen to you. We're not going to let you die. You know, we'll fight with you. We'll give our lives for you, and we want you to stay here with us. You know, don't give your life up like that. And he told him, "Get behind him, Satan," because he knew that wasn't Peter. That was it wasn't Satan per se in him, but it was Peter. Satan had already given him those thoughts, and he was speaking as human. His human capacity of his mind was thinking, this is what we would do to protect you. We're not going to let this happen. But that's not what God's intention was. And Christ was telling him, "Get behind me, Satan," because the way you're thinking is not the way that God thinks. This is not what God wants. And his whole purpose, Christ's whole purpose, was to come here and do the will of God, not to do the will of men, not to do his own will, but to do what God wanted him to do. And so we see that, you know, and again, he tried to tell them a couple of other times, and they didn't understand, and they didn't want to hear it. You know, they just couldn't grasp the fact of Christ leaving them, because after 3 years of being with him and seeing the miracles he performed and stuff, it was like, well, if you leave, what's going to happen to us? What are we going to do then? You know, we've been following you. We've been believing everything you say. You've been showing us signs, and now you're going up and leave us? And then he tells them that when I leave, you know, you're going to be all right. You know, everything's going to be all right. It's going to be joyful times afterward. How could it be joyful times? You're going to be gone. We had joyful times while you were here, seeing all the miracles you performed. Now you're going to leave us and tell me we're going to have joyful times, and plus the fact you're going to die? Nah, we don't understand that, you know. So this was a hard thing for them to grasp. We're going to look now at the book of John, chapter 16, verses 16 through 24. John chapter 16, verses 16 through 24. And it reads as such. John chapter 16, verses 16 through 24. A little while, and you will not see me. And again, a little while, and you will see me, because I go to the Father. Then some of his disciples said among themselves, "What is this that he says to us? A little while, and you will not see me. And again, a little while, and you will see me. And because I go to the Father." They said, "Therefore, what is this that he says, a little while? Do we not know what he is saying?" Now Jesus knew that they desired to ask him, and he said to them, "Are you inquiring among yourselves about what I said, 'A little while and you will not see me, and again, a little while and you will see me?' Most assuredly, I say to you, that you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice, and you will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will be turned into joy. A woman, when she is in labor, has sorrow because her hour has come. But as soon as she has given birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. Therefore, you now have sorrow, but I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice, and your joy no one will take from you. And in that day, you will ask me nothing. Most assuredly, I say to you, whatsoever you ask the Father in my name, he will give you. Until now, you have asked nothing in my name. Ask, and you will receive, that your joy may be full." Now, looking at these verses, we see the truth of what Christ is telling his disciples. And by those truths that we see, we're hoping that it will help strengthen our faith as we live each day by knowing these truths. And it's easier for us now to see things because we're on this side of the cross. We're after the fact. Of course, those disciples at that time was before the fact. So it was difficult for them to understand and to see exactly what Christ was talking about. And the first truth in that verse 16, the truth that Jesus is trying to tell him is that he is going to die and he is about to conquer death. He's going to be raised from the dead and he's going to come back to them again. As I said before, it's hard for them to understand because they'd never seen that before. It was just about as hard as if the time when they was on the ship and Peter saw him walking on water. He actually saw that, but he couldn't believe it. And he told Christ, "If that's you, let me come out to you." But if Christ had told him, "I'm going to walk on water," he would have said, "Yeah, right. Okay, maybe. If you said it, I believe it because I've seen you already do some stuff." But it still would have been a little bit of, "How's he going to do that?" in his mind. He would have just accepted that, well, Christ said it, so that means he's going to do it. We live by faith today. So what we read from the Bible and know of Christ's words, we accept it by faith. We don't question it because we believe that what Christ says is true. even though we don't see it. That's what faith is all about. And at that time, the disciples had faith, but it was still a little doubt in there because of they had never seen it, and they couldn't understand or grasp at that time just what he was telling them. Now, also, by the way, feel free if any time you want to add comments or make comments or jump into the lesson.
Sometimes we see that Jesus will tell them something plainly and wonder why can't they understand that?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes he would speak metaphorically and they never were certain whether he was speaking literally or whether he was speaking figuratively when he was talking, because he said, you know, tear down this temple and in 3 days build it up again. But he was talking about his body at that time, not literally the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Later on he says the temple is going to be torn down, and he meant literally that the temple would be torn down.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So it was hard for them to decide, okay, do we believe that exactly what he said, or is he just trying to make a point here, or is it going to be something we'll understand later?
That's true. And with a lot of the parables that he told, it was hard for them to grasp exactly what was the meaning behind it. But in this case, when he told them that he was going to leave them, of course, when he first told them that he was going to leave them, he made it plain to them to know that it wasn't in parable. He told them straight up that I must die. I'm going to be delivered to my enemies in Jerusalem. We're going to Jerusalem. My enemies there is going to kill me, but this is what I have to do. And they just didn't want to accept it because, again, they could see the great loss that they would experience. Now, in verses 17 and 18, where they were talking among themselves, they were trying to figure out what he was saying, asking each other, what is he talking about? Why is he saying such things? And the truth we can see in this is that Jesus' words, at times, as you say, it was confusing, but it was still also true, what he was telling them. It was just the way in which he was putting it sometimes was just hard for them hard for them to understand. But they did have the ability to ask him, what do you mean? Why would you say that? But for fear, because of who he was, I think that a lot of times they wouldn't say anything. You know, they just, whatever he said, they would get amongst themselves and say, do you know what he meant? Do you understand?
They don't want to sound stupid by asking.
That's it.
Because when he says, I'm going to go away for a little while, that doesn't sound like he's going to die and then be raised from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, you know, hey, I'm going on a business trip or something somewhere, and then I'll come back. So you can't really blame him.
That's true.
Exactly.
And then they didn't know exactly when he was going to leave. Like, how soon is it going to happen? We know at that time they were on their way to Jerusalem anyway for the Passover. So is this going to be before we go or after we get there? Or what's going to happen?
Part of their question is, okay, what's a little while?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true. Okay, as we look a little bit further, another point we wanted to look at is the fact that because they went to each other and tried to figure out what he was saying, that's a good thing in one sense, because we today, when we have questions about the Bible, something we might have read, or we may be in service, and we heard something that the speaker may say that morning. We don't fully understand, and we don't get it. We have the ability to come together and ask each other. We also have the ability of coming to Bible study and trying to understand exactly what is being presented. But we can't forget that we also have the ability to go to God in prayer and ask Him to enlighten us, to increase our understanding, so that we can understand exactly what it is that He desires us to do. Now, some things, some questions you might have, you can go to the Bible and get an answer for. Some things you can't. And that is why you have the ability to go to other Christians. But just as in the case with the disciples, nobody knew exactly what Christ was saying. Nobody went to Christ and asked Him exactly what He was saying. So all of them were sort of still in the dark, you know. But we do have the Bible to help us clarify things. And we do have Bible study because the one thing that God does do, He uses each other brothers and sisters, our minister, elders, and other members to help us clarify things or give us a better understanding of things. And it could be from an experience, personal life experiences that others have had that could tell you things that will help you see things a little bit better. An example, say, you may find yourself in a situation where you've lost your job, and how am I going to make it now that I don't have a job, I can't support myself anymore. What am I going to do? And the Bible tells us, trust in the Lord. And, you know, we're trusting in the Lord, but we also saying ourselves the bills still have to be paid. So what do I do? Well, number one, we know we're not going to go out here and rob nobody. But when you go to another brother or sister, or you come to the church, the committee that oversees the benevolence funds, or you may talk to our preacher or elder or a group of members, or bring it up in a Bible study that you are in need because of the fact that you lost jobs, you can get some relief from, I don't think relief is a good word, you can get some comfort from another member telling you, yeah, you know, I've been through the same thing. I at a time, I didn't have a job, and I prayed, and I came to church, and I told the members, and I told the elders about it, and they helped me. They helped support me. They helped carry me through. One of the elders even found me a job. Maybe one of the members even gave me some information of where I could go and get other employment at. The group together is what God uses to help lift each other up and to help each other in cases of emergencies and in cases of need. This is what we're supposed to do anyway as followers of Christ, is to look out for the less fortunate, whether it be within our congregation or whether it be outside of the congregation. When we see a need, we're supposed to help fill that need. But if you don't let somebody know, how can you get any help? But what I'm saying is the fact that coming to the group, coming to speaking to someone about it, letting them know about your problem, you can find solution because God works through other people to help you. But you may not be able to find the exact answer or the exact help you need immediately, from the Bible, you can't find comfort, but you may need immediate help. And that is the benefit of coming together to the congregation, coming together with your church members, coming together with the elders or the preacher, or looking to within the church family for the good help. I hope I'm not confusing you with what I'm saying, but what I'm trying to say is, it's not only just reading the Bible and thinking you can solve the problem yourself, but you come within the group to seek help. God is there, and he's going to work through them to help you. But if you don't come forward, who knows what kind of help can you receive? In the case of the disciples, with all of them asking each other, what is he saying? What does he mean? When is he going to leave? What's going to happen? All of the questions they wanted answered, nobody came to Christ and asked him, what do you mean? Why are you saying these things? What should we do? They were just asking each other, and as it turned out, nobody had the answer. So they were still, as the saying goes, the blind leading the blind, so to speak. They didn't receive any help because none of them knew the answer. Y'all understand what I'm saying? Nobody understands what I'm saying. I'm trying to explain. I hope I'm trying to get the point over to you. But this is the difference in not just trying to solve the problem all by yourself, or just keeping it to yourself, or asking people that don't have the answer. If you come together, you don't get an answer, don't just stop there. Go to the source and pray and read your Bible, and God will give you the answer. If you seek, you will find it. Yes. Mm-hmm. Another good example is when I believe it was when Paul met the eunuch, and he explained things to him. He asked the eunuch, do you understand what you're reading? He said, how can I let somebody teach me? But still, it was the point of him explaining things to him to help him to understand. The same way is when you come, I say the group, but I mean the church, within the church. Okay, as we look at a little bit further, verses 19 and 20, when Christ is talking about his death, and his death will turn to joy for his people, or for, in this case, his disciples. He knew that they would face a lot of sadness and gloom, and they would have uncertainty, and he wanted to reassure them that what was coming up, even though they would go through a rough time, that they would still make it out and see joy at the end of it. He didn't minimize the fact that it was going to be suffering. He let them know that they would be stressed and deep grief, just like the mourners. When death comes about, people be mourning, and you have a real deep grief, real deep sadness for the loss of your loved one. That's inevitable. You're not going to be able to get around that. But after that passes, then the time after that will be time for rejoicing. Again, he tried to explain that to them and used an example. And from verses 21 and 22, using the woman having a baby as an example. I never experienced that. Some men, as fathers, you have experienced anxiety and anxiousness because your wife or girlfriend is having a baby. You're hoping that the baby is going to be okay, be born with no defects. You're worried about your wife or your girlfriend that nothing will happen to her in the process of her giving birth. You're hoping that the doctors is going to do everything he's supposed to do right and not cause any problems. You just worried that everything comes through perfectly until you get the news that you're the proud father of a girl or boy. But until that time, you just count on pins and needles, so to speak. But the woman is going through much more than that. She's going through pain and suffering that I could never explain and never give credit to. Women know about it, but guys, in that example, we are gifted. We don't have to worry about experiencing nothing like that. But the women carry that burden. And from what I know of it, or what I've been told of it, it's the worst pain that a woman could experience. But after that point, as soon as the baby is delivered, all the pain is gone. And he uses this example as to the joy that they will feel once they see him again after they go through all the misery. And that is a good example. I can't think of anything that would compare to that. It's nothing really that you can compare to it, because Christ could use the best example he could use, I'm sure. We can liken it to some other examples of experiencing pain, such as a bad toothache that's got your jaw sitting out, you can't eat, you can't sleep, your head hurting, you're miserable. But even as soon as the doctor pulls that tooth, you still kind of out of it until all of that stuff wears out and you heal up. But with the example that Christ used of a woman, immediately after she gives birth, her anguish and her pain turns to joy. It's nothing that really can compare to that. And he explains it so well that, you know, it's nothing that even though you don't experience it, you still can understand exactly what he means. I don't think nothing happens as quickly as that. Just in a split second, that it's just over with. The pain is over, and you are filled with joy from having knowing that your child is born and living. So Christ uses that to try to get his disciples to see that this is what he means when they will experience joy, and that the joy will not be taken away from again, because they will know that Christ lives, because they will be able to see him once he would appear to them again. They will see him and they will be so happy to know that he lives, and we can be happy to know, because Christ rose, that he still lives, and he has paid the debt of our sin forever. And he intercedes for us on the right hand of God right today for as long as we live and for all eternity. Even when we die, he still be sitting right there, and he still be interceding for those that come after us. So that is comforting to know for us, and it should be joyful for us to know that we have that to count on, and we can look forward to that. Of course, it wouldn't compare to the joy that we'll have or we'll experience when we actually do get to see him face to face. There's no way you can describe that. Once we see him, we say we'll have 1,000 questions we want to ask. I don't think none of that would matter at that time when we do see him. We won't think of anything that we wanted to ask because we'd be so happy that we got there, that we see him, and that we actually can see what he looks like. We can actually touch him. We'll actually know all of the suffering he went through was for this one moment, for us to be right there for all eternity. There's no way to explain it. But we have that to look forward to. And that's what we base our faith on, that we will look forward to seeing him in the end, at the end of our life. So that is the first part of my lesson for today. Hopefully next Sunday, I will complete this, where we will talk about when Christ, after he rose, and he came back to the disciples and to Mary Magdalene, and how he had to still convince them of their unbelief. Is that really you? You come back, you say you were going to come back, but then we actually see you. Is it really you? Or are we dreaming? But I hope you got something from this lesson this morning, and I hope I didn't confuse you too much. So that's my lesson for this morning. Thank you for your participation.